We're kind of like frogs.
So,
are you wearing a wire like stuff in here? Why don't you just tape it to your chest?
Because then I'd have to tear off all my chest hair when I took it off. Pocket is much more efficient, don't you think? So, I thought, I mean, this is kind of a little weird in its own way because you're all friends, or will be friends, and so this is kind of a role shift, so it'll be a little strange to get this all sorted out, but Kay and I have really for a long time thought that it would be nice to have some Buddhist friends in the environment, and when Maida would come here, it was nice to hang out with her. But I'm thinking that the best way to have that happen is to just have that happen, because it's us. So, it's us. In our tradition, in our Tibetan tradition, because we are connected with both Zen and Tibetan traditions, teachers have a habit of introducing themselves, and it's like, why are they in a position that to teach anything about Buddhism is basically what they start off by saying. And that seemed like a really nice way to start whatever it is that we're starting, because really you know me as whatever you know me as, but you don't know me as a Buddhist teacher, as a Buddhist scholar in any way, or my background, or what I look like in those clothes or in that guise. But I do have that part of myself, and probably in the last 20 or 25 years, I've done a couple of hundred Buddhist talks in California and New Mexico. I've been teaching in universities for 25 or 30 years. So let me take a minute to tell you about myself, and Kay will do the same. And what we thought we would do tonight is introduce ourselves as these other people who we sort of know but sort of don't know. Then I thought I'd also do a little bit of philosophical kind of talk, set the stage for things. Kay is actually the meditation expert, and so we're going to work as a team, but she is, it's true. So we'll work as a team, and then she'll do a little meditation. And then, you know, if you have questions, we can get into that too. But we thought in general what we would more typically do is that we'd start with meditation in the future. And she would pick a certain meditation to do. There's a large number that she's been taught and that she can pass on. And then I would do kind of a philosophy talk, something like that. And then we do question and answer. And the nice thing about that arrangement is if you don't want to stay for question and answer, then you can split and go on about whatever it is that you have to do. And I'll record whatever I do and put it on the internet on our website, which is komito.com, so it's not too hard to find. And you know, we can have some continuity that way, which is what I was thinking about in doing that. So does that sound like a good thing for everybody? Sounds good? Sounds good? Okay. And we'll just see where this goes. I don't know where this is going to go, you know. We'll see what it is LeGrand wants to have happen. So, for me, the study and practice of Buddhism began with a Vietnamese teacher who I met at UCLA when I was an undergraduate. He was fleeing the Vietnam War, and he was my first Buddhist teacher. His name was Thich Thien An. Since then, the major teachers that he was a Zen teacher. Since then, the major teachers that came into my life were someone called Tara Tulku, who I met in the early 1980s. And he was a retired abbot of a monastery. In fact, he'd helped restart that monastery after the Tibetan diaspora. And I met him in India when I was doing some translating. And then I had the good fortune to study with him pretty closely for about a year in Amherst. And I think he really got my Buddhist life going, because it was sort of, I was sort of flopping around all over the place between the 60s and the in the early 80s when I ran into him. I had a number of different kinds of teachers who did different things, but he really got things going. And he was, and I say was because he's deceased, he was really impeccable, as Yvonne Rand described him. He was one of the old traditional Tibetan teachers, but he realized that the world had changed, and he was into trying to find a way to bring these two different things together. And Kay and I actually studied with him until the time he died, which was in 1991. And then at the time that he died, and he taught us a lot of different kind of philosophical teachings and a couple of core meditation practices that we've been doing ever since. We did a number of retreats with him. And I would say that anything that I have to pass along really began with my being his student and his filling me with anything that I know, for starters. Kay visited him just before he died, and at that point he very graciously said to her that the two of us should go have a meeting with the Dalai Lama to figure out what to do next in our spiritual practice. And he connected us with the man who's been our teacher ever since, who was at that time, well, still is, the retired abbot of the Dalai Lama's monastery. And so Kay and I have studied with him ever since that time. And again, anything that I have to say, anything that I know, really depends upon those three teachers. Dengma Lhotse Rinpoche, who's our current teacher, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who's been in and out of my life since the 1970s, and Tara Tolkien, who was sort of our basic foundational teacher. And they're the source. So that's, you know, if in sitting here and talking to you, I could say, well, okay, I have a PhD in Tibetan Buddhism and I've studied all the world religions and all that stuff, but none of that would really mean anything, because what Buddhist teaching is about at core is a way of living, and those people showed me that stuff. The academics just showed me the intellectual stuff, and they got me ready. That's where it all comes from. And to the extent that there's anything I have to pass along, it's from them. So I need to acknowledge that. But I thought I would start at the beginning, actually, with something, probably the only thing that I remember that, well, I remember two things that Thich Nhat Hanh taught in the 1960s in Los Angeles. One is something I can't really communicate. It was just the way he looked when he would sit down and meditate. He just had this nice look. He got real peaceful. he kind of looked like one of those Asian statues, you know, that you see. And I thought, oh, that's pretty cool. I'd like to have, I don't know what's going on in there, but it looks pretty good. I'd like to be able to do that. So I can't really communicate any of that. I can't show you what that smile looked like or how he composed himself. But he said something that stuck with me in a kind of a story, if you will, that I think it's kind of a good place to start any kind of sequence of teaching or whatever it is that we're doing. And the story was, he said, if two people walked out of a hut or out of a cabin or out of a house in a dark night, and one said to the other, "Where's the moon?" The person who was asked the question would probably point and say, "Over there." And the moon in this story is kind of a metaphor for one's deep inner being, one's deep inner self, one's Buddha nature is what Buddhists would call it, or one's enlightened self or something like that. Maybe at some point we'll get to talking about what these things mean. But the thing about the story that is interesting is if two people walk out of a house, and why would one of them ask the other one, where is the moon? I mean, so there's a deep meaning to this, where is the moon story. So I'll ask you, why would one of them ask the other one, where is the moon? I mean, why would you ask that question? Isn't it obvious? No comment. No thought. Well, all right. If the moon is our deep nature, why is it that we don't see it? Why is it that we have to ask somebody to point to us where it is? And what is the finger that's pointing? What is the finger that's pointing at the moon? So that story has sort of stuck with me since 1966. So that's a pretty long time for a story to stick. And Buddhist teachings are the finger pointing at the moon. That's what they are. Everything that the Buddha taught, everything that Taratulka taught me, Dhammalocha Rinpoche, His Holiness, it's all like the finger pointing at the moon. Now, you don't really need to have a finger pointing at the moon. I mean, basically, you just need to look at it because there it is. It's just that for some reason, we don't see it. It's like the deepest part of ourself, that central core peaceful part of ourself that we want to reconnect with, I think, at least that I want to reconnect with. It's always there. It's always there to be seen. It's just for some reason we don't see it. And so kind of a key question is how come we don't see it when it's always there? And we have to ask for somebody to point out to us what should be completely apparent, if that other person can see it, I could see it. The other thing about this story, and the thing about this story that first struck me when I heard it, was that if you ask somebody, where is the moon? Over there. Well, in order to know where over there is, first you've got to look at their finger, then you have to look at what it's pointing at, in this case, the moon. So, unless you stop looking at their finger, you can't see the moon. I mean, it's great to ask the question, it's great to have somebody point to it, but you have to look at it. You have to, stop looking at the finger and start looking at the moon. And if you forget to do that, you never see the moon. So if the Buddhist teachings are like the finger pointing at the moon, not only in a funny way is there some strange question about why you should even need to ask or have somebody point it out, but the other thing is, at some point you have to stop looking at the finger and pay attention to the moon. You have to, I mean, the words are important, the discourse, the language is important, but there's a point where you have to do this thing, look away from it. And I don't know, maybe if you don't see the moon, you might ask the question again, and maybe someone's pointing another direction, if they're playing tricks on you or something, I don't know. But you get the general idea. That stuck with me my whole life, that that's very important to not be trapped by the words that are supposed to be informing you and freeing you. So at the moment I have some kind of correspondence that's going on with a Brazilian graduate student who's studying Sanskrit Buddhism with a professor in Rome, and he's corresponding with me. I mean, this is the modern world, right? But that's great. And he's corresponding with me because in the early 80s I started writing a book on Buddhist philosophy, which was published in 87, and it's been in print ever since, and he likes it a lot, and so he had some questions about something, and so he's written to me, and I've answered some of his questions. Now he's asked more questions. Well, the last set of questions that he asked were, well, there's some logical problems here in this text. And there are other scholars who think this, that, and the other thing. And I just was reminded in thinking about what I wanted to say to him, because I haven't said it yet in very much detail, and thinking about what I want to say to him is that it's the moon, it's not the finger. You know, let go of the words. The words are useful, but don't get stuck in them. And he's kind of hung up with all these, because he's a graduate student, and he has to write a dissertation, he's hung up with all these philosophers who think this, that, and the other thing. And they're all stuck inside their own minds, trying to understand things, trying to, you know, interpret these texts, and what did this old philosopher Nagarjuna really mean, and what does this word mean in Sanskrit, and this scholar says this and that. That's all really useful, but it's also a stuck place. And I thought, you know, I can't help him with his Sanskrit translation. I'm too far out of it. I haven't dealt with that stuff for years. But maybe I can remind him about not getting stuck. So if we really progress, you know, in some way here in LeGrand, there'll be a lot of words. I have a lot of words that I can say. But it's also important to get beyond those. And I, at least, if I've achieved anything in my own Buddhist practice, it's to know better than to get stuck by the words. I don't get stuck by the words anymore. I really know that they're just useful, but then that's that. So that's, I guess, by way of prologue, or by way of beginning, sort of setting the tone for the way I think about things, the way I tend to teach. Shall I continue on, or shall we? Yeah? Yeah? All right. If you pick up a college level textbook about Buddhism, and they have, you know, 30-page chapter, they always start the same way. They always start by saying, "Well, the Buddha, this was his life, blah blah blah," and then he taught the following. And what he taught was usually what's called the Four Noble Truths, and the way that's usually portrayed is: existence is suffering. Desire is the source of suffering. If you cease desire, then you'll be free of suffering, and the Buddhist path is about ceasing desire so you can be free of suffering. And mostly Americans hear that and they think, ugh, I mean, what's that all about? You know, it's like, it doesn't really fit our view of what's going on very well. So in general, I don't like to start that way, even though in a funny way I just did start that way. But I'm going to say that's not the way I want to start. But I want to start in a different way. It's not that that's not true. It's just it takes a while to figure out what the word suffering really means. Because it mostly means something like dissatisfaction. Things don't quite fit together well. The original term in Sanskrit, which is dukkha, referred to something about what was then a very new technology called the wheel. I mean, the Buddha goes back to the point where wheels on vehicles were not very common. And so, I mean, actually, they weren't invented around his time, but they weren't a very common kind of thing everywhere. Anyway, the word referred to a wheel which was set on an axle incorrectly, so it wobbled. And so the idea was that there's something about life that doesn't quite work out. There's some kind of like a wobble that's going on. It doesn't quite jive in some way. No matter what you do, you can't quite get that wheel just right on the axle. No matter what you do, you can't quite get everything to work. In the ancient days, you know, you wanted to have lots of sons. That was a good thing. You wanted to have lots of cows. That was a good thing. Well, you know, the cows would get sick. The sons would do what sons do. They'd be a pain in the neck and give you a hard time or whatever. But anyhow, they wouldn't be what you wanted them to be. So that's the way they thought about things. But I don't really, it's not that that's not true once you get into understanding what the Buddhists meant about it, but I don't think it's a very good way to start teaching for Americans. I think a better way to start teaching for Americans, or maybe Westerners in general, is that there's the way we see things in our life, and then there's the way things really are. And there's a big distinction between the way things really are and the way we see things. And this has to do with all the people that are around us, the physical world that's around us, the social world that's around us, the economic world. I mean, take your pick. It doesn't matter what it is. Whatever it is, we bring a certain kind of a limited perspective to our experience. We bring a perspective that's so strongly influenced by what we want, what we desire, what we're afraid of, and what we believe, that it's very hard to actually experience what's there. We don't really see what's there. We see what we think is there. We don't really hear or feel what's there. We hear and we feel what we want to hear and feel. I mean, there's an old saying that I guess is it from the Midwest? Maybe this is from Missouri. I don't know. Seeing is believing. Where does that come from? Seeing is believing. Well, and from the Buddhist point of view, believing is seeing. And I think that there's a lot of truth to that. Believing is seeing. You know, if you believe the world is an ornery place that's out to get you, that's what you run into all the time. If you believe the world is a nice place that's just ready to give you what you want and take care of you, that's mostly what you run into. Can't even talk about this a lot because there's kind of the difference between us. You know, I'm Jewish by origin, so for sure my view of the world is it's out to get you. Don't trust it. It's not going to give you what you want. You know, you can't be cynical enough. And Kay's view, you know, Kay grew up in Nebraska in a much more kind of like peaceful, optimistic environment, you know, small town, and has much more of an idea that if you really, you know, the world is really kind of an okay place, and it's mostly going to do for you what you want it to do, and you can trust it. So we have kind of interesting dynamics over this particular issue. But anyway, back to believing is seeing. So this is kind of like a Buddhist axiom, believing and seeing. And so what the enterprise of Buddhism is about, in the most fundamental way, and it's actually incredibly simple, is to deeply come to understand not just what that means, but how that works, how believing and seeing really works, how the mind changes what's out there because of what we believe. Excuse me, not how that the mind changes what's out there, how the mind changes our experience of what's out there because of what we believe and what our history was and all of these kinds of things. And you know, you could even ask, well, so what? I mean, why do we want to experience what's actually there instead of what we think is there? I mean, like, we go to Disneyland because it's a big fantasy and isn't that great. That's okay, but, you know, the bill comes due even when you go to Disneyland. And the problem is that what we believe about things and the way we relate to people because of all of our habit patterns and how we relate to our lives and what we expect for our lives, it all tends to not work out quite well because what we believe is not what's actually going on. What we want is not aligned with what's real. What we're afraid of may be completely untrue. And so we are walking around with a fear and a concern that's completely unfounded. And all these kinds of things are in operation. And so life is not completely satisfactory. It's like this wheel that's wobbling just because of what we bring to the experience, not necessarily because of what's there, although there are issues about what's there. I mean, the fact is we're all going to die, and that's just the way it is. Well, that's what's there. But how we relate to that fact That's what we bring to it. So the enterprise of Buddhism is about this problem. And because, I mean, you can describe it as a problem. The parakeets upstairs have a version of this problem. It's not as big a version as we have because they don't have a whole lot of expectations, you know. But they get freaked out when one of their mates dies. They just don't know what to do, and they go into shock. I mean, you know, they do have these kinds of experiences. But, you know, their experiences are probably much more aligned with what's real than our own because they have more limited expectations. And we have something they don't have, a certain kind of self-consciousness that's associated with language and experience. And in some ways that makes things better, and in some ways that makes things worse. Excuse me. So the distinction between what's really going on and what our experience is of what's going on is sort of the fundamental thing in Buddhism, and that's sometimes called the two truths. Because it's not that what's really there is true and that our thoughts about what's there are completely false. They're both true in their own way, which may sound odd given what I just got through saying. But what we think is going on does serve us in a way, and we all agree about that. You know, it's like traffic lights. I mean, traffic lights are sort of arbitrary. You know, why is the light turned green, red now, and so on and so forth. It's just, you know, it's an agreement that Legrand has made with us, and we've made with Legrand, about what happens when you get to the intersection of Island Avenue and North Adams. You know, it is North Adams, isn't it? You know, that intersection by the bridge. It's like, okay, when the light turns red, I'm not going to go anyplace. That's just an agreement we have, and when it turns green, I will, and that way we don't crunch each other. So that kind of reality that we agree upon is real, I mean, in a way, but how real is it? I mean, it doesn't speak to anything deeply fundamental. It speaks to convention. It speaks to agreements that we have, and those things are necessary for human life to get on, even if they're wrong about certain things. I mean, at 2 o'clock in the morning, I can pull up to that intersection, and the light can be red, and there's not a car in sight, and then the question is, what do I do? Do I decide to... I wait. Because, you know, it's like the agreement. I mean, the rational person would look at that and say, what am I doing sitting here? The reality is there's not a car in sight. I can ignore the agreement. Well, you know... That's the way I was brought up. I'll sit there and wait for the light. So, there are these two environments, what's really there and what we think is going on. And one is called the conventional truth. That's the way things appear. And the other is called the absolute or the ultimate truth, which is the way things really are. And the Buddhist view is that if you don't experience the absolute truth of things, if you don't experience the way things really are, you're never going to find any peace, because you won't find peace in the conventional realm of things. On the other hand, to think that you can live in that absolute realm and not live in the conventional realm suggests that you could live without human beings around you or other animals around you or whatever. And, I mean, there are some religions that suggest you'd want to do that. Buddhism does not. It suggests that you have to find a way to live in both places at the same time, harmoniously. Because if you don't live in the conventional world, you're living out of relationship with other people. And if you're a human being, you're not designed to live out of relationship with other people for the most part. And it doesn't make sense for other reasons that we'll get into later. But if you don't find a way to spend some time in this other realm, this absolute realm, you don't really have a very satisfactory existence. Now, it's easy to think about these two realms, these two truths, as separate from each other, like one's here and one's over there. That would be a mistake from the Buddhist point of view. It's not like they're two different places. It's not like there's the world and heaven. here's the ordinary world, which is conventional, and here's heaven, which is the absolute. It's more like there's this one realm of potential experience, and what you bring to it determines whether or not you experience it in the conventional sense or you experience it in the absolute sense. There's just the one thing. Now, for those of us who are ordinary, like all of us, what we bring to our experiences, we come to the ordinary, we come to the conventional, and it's an achievement to get a glimpse of the non-ordinary, of the absolute, the ultimate, which is sort of like minus all of our fantasies, reality minus all of our fantasies. And it's such an achievement that it feels like it's someplace else, but it isn't anyplace else. It's just, what do I bring to what's here? If I bring clarity to what's here and don't bring a lot of neuroticism and don't bring my fantasies to what's here, then it's reality, capital R, absolute reality. And if I bring all my own stuff to what's here, then it's something else. It's conventional reality. But there's it's not like there's someplace else. I mean, in many religions, it's sort of like, here's the world and here's heaven. And if you do all this kind of stuff when you're here, you know, then you die and you get to go to heaven. And so there's here and there's there. And they're not in the same place at the same time. And the thing that is unique about Buddhism, well, not totally unique, find this in Hinduism and Sufism, and a lot of mystical traditions, so I shouldn't say it's unique. But Buddhists are explicit about this, that there's just what is. And if it appears to be one way one time and another way another time, it's because of you. It's not because of it. And there's only that. Now, that could be viewed in very many different kind of ways, and it raises questions about what happens when I die. You know, do I hang around? Do I don't hang around? Where did I come from? Where am I going? How big am I? How extensive am I? That's what I mean. You know, do I encompass a lot or just this flesh here? And, you know, we'll talk about those things if you want to as time goes on, because all those questions come up. But still, the root thing is there's just what is. And what I bring to what is, if I bring a bunch of fantasy, the technical term for that is called samsara, the world of cyclic existence or suffering. And if I don't bring my fantasies to it, but just meet it for what it truly is, then that's called nirvana. It's called peace. And there's no difference between nirvana and samsara. There's just what is, and there's me and what I bring to it. And that's another thing that the textbooks will talk about that eventually, but in the beginning they don't. Because then it's easy to misunderstand what that means. It's easy to misunderstand what all this stuff means, in fact. It takes quite a long time to sort it out. Because we bring our own ideas to all these ideas, and we think we know what these ideas mean. And it becomes a huge challenge to get at what the Buddhists really say about these things versus what do we think the Buddhists say about these things. So I'll try and share what I think the Buddhists say about these things. There we go, paradox. But I'll do my best, because I've been wrestling with this problem now for a long time. And on some things I have a reasonable handle. But then we'll have to talk about it. There's what I say and what you hear. And that will create all kinds of confusion. So we have plenty of opportunity to work our way through all kinds of confusion, if we want to take the opportunity to do it. But then the core thing is that although it's really important to know that there is a finger that's going to point to the moon, and to look at the finger so we can find out where the moon is, it's also really important to stop looking at the finger and see the moon. And that's what meditation is about. That's going to be for Kay. So that's more than enough for me to say tonight.
Thank you. I thought we'd jump right into that. Thank you. And each time I'm going to try and segue the meditation that I'm bringing forward.